Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He's also the managing director of a strategic investment group located in Doha, in Qatar, which is incidentally the headquarters for the Middle East command conducting the war against Iraq. And he specializes in risk analysis and the oil market. But he's also, as I mentioned, a 25-year veteran of the New York Times. And we'll be talking to him in a moment about the referendum in Iraq, the letter purported to be between the number two guy in al-Qaeda, Zahawi, to Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Some doubt about the authenticity of that letter. We'll look into that, and we'll also talk about the New York Times and the Judy Miller story, given that Sunday's New York Times has two articles, one by Judy Miller about what she spoke to the special prosecutor about, and an extensive article written by two Times reporters on the whole subject matter of the special prosecutor and the Times' role in that. And there's quite a difference between those two articles, indicating there's something of a perhaps even a civil war going on at the New York Times. We'll also be joined by Bill Press, who is a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. He was co-host of MSNBC's Buchanan and Press and also CNN's Crossfire. He's served as chairman of the California Democratic Party, and he has a new book, How the Republicans Stole Christmas, The Republican Party's Declared Monopoly on Religion and What Democrats Can Do to Take It Back. We'll be talking, obviously, quite a bit about the religious rights capture of the Republican Party and the fact that the Democrats seem to be, by default, finding themselves in a situation where they may be able to conduct regime change in 06. We look into the possibilities of whether or not, or what perhaps the Democratic version of the contract with America will be. We'll also talk with Peter Irons. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, the author of a number of books, including A People's History of the Supreme Court. His new book is War Powers, How the Imperial Presidency Hijacked the Constitution. Let me begin now with Yusuf Ibrahim, who has been a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent for the New York Times, and he is now the managing director of Strategic Investment Group in Doha, in Qatar, where he specializes in the oil market and in risk analysis. Let's begin with the election in Iraq, the referendum on a new constitution. There are indications from Condoleezza Rice that early indications that she suggests that the referendum will pass. There's sort of mixed reviews from the Sunni side, half boycotting and half not. Do you think this is going to make any difference? I mean, some people like Scowcroft have been saying for the longest time that this, rather than bring this country together, this may tear it apart. What would your analysis be, Yusuf?
I would tend to believe that the referendum and the new constitution altogether open the door to either one of two things, either a federal republic, which works, or in fact the splitting apart of Iraq. Given some of the neoconservative thinking going into this war and during this war, and by neoconservative in this case, I mean both neoconservatives in the Republican Party and people like Leslie Galbraith and so on and so forth in the Democratic Party, they have always favored splitting up Iraq. They think the ultimate insurance against the resurgence of a strong Iraq is by splitting it into a Kurdish nation, a Shiite nation in the south, with albeit accepting the risk that this part will be allied with Iran, and the Sunni middle. I was hopeful immediately when 8 million Iraqis walked to the poll and voted on a new constitution or the concept of a new constitution, that things were coming together, but I think the insurgency has widened since then, and the chaos in Iraq is such that at this point the referendum in many ways is becoming irrelevant. What's more relevant here is whether we, the American forces, or the Iraqis themselves will be able to contain this insurgency. And I'm not so sure that this is going to be the case. So my answer to your question is the referendum is an exercise. It is fine. I mean, one wishes for Iraq to become a democratic nation. Whether the referendum will serve that purpose is doubtful.
Well, obviously, if there is a declaration of independence on the part of the Kurds, the Turks would probably, could go as far as invading. Certainly what they do is they turn off the oil spigot because the oil from Kirkuk goes through Turkey. The Sunni would be left with nothing. The Iranians, with their influence, or perhaps even domination of the Shiite part, that's where 80% of the oil is. There's some suggestion that the Shiite Republic of Iran will become of Iraq will become an extension of Iran. So if people like Leslie Gelb think that a breakup is a good thing, it's not going to be a bloodless divorce.
No, it's going to be a civil war. And again, I think I look at the picture that's much darker than what you suggested. Many people are not noticing this, but the insurgency's purpose and goals have shifted. At first, it was fighting the American occupation, but now it is simply spreading chaos, because if you spread chaos to the point that it is happening, you, in the end of the day, defeat the American project, which was to go in there, get rid of Saddam Hussein, and create a country that's friendly to the West and democratic. Now, we are very far away from this, but what really worries me is that the tools that the insurgency is using in order to defeat the American project, and this is the first time in an insurgency since the days of the Iranian Revolution, the Algerian Civil War, where we see in an oil-producing country insurgents or opponents destroying oil facilities as a way to destroy the government. Now, many of these insurgents, we don't know how many, perhaps 2,000, perhaps as many as 20,000, are coming from outside the country, and many of these are Saudis and Jordanians and Algerians. And this concept of attacking oil facilities as a way to destabilize your government is going to develop legs. You can be absolutely sure of this. When these guys go back to the Saudi insurgents, go back to Saudi Arabia, they will go back with the idea that, hey, this works. It worked in Iraq. So in many ways, Iraq is becoming a catastrophe because first, it's falling apart. Second, it's heading towards a civil war. And third, it's becoming as the center of inventing new methods to fight by extremists and insurgents. We are in the part of the world that contains two-thirds of the world energy reserves, oil and gas. And the world is running out of energy reserves elsewhere, and we are coming back to Middle Eastern oil, which explains the $70 or $60 per barrel. So this is getting much more serious than merely whether we can get out of Iraq. The question is, what is Iraq going to do to completely destabilize the whole region?
Well, let me just remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent for the New York Times, and he is now the managing director of Strategic Investment Group in Doha.
In Dubai, yeah.
Oh, it's in Dubai. I thought it was in Doha. Last time I talked to you in Doha.
No, Dubai is more fun.
Okay, really? Well, that's another conversation. But I wanted to mention to the audience, too, that Yusuf Ibrahim, we've spoken before, well before this war began, we talked about this war in terms of it being a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. And we've had to revise that appraisal somewhat. It's as though the quick victory has been followed by a quick defeat, given that there are rumblings from the U.S. military about pulling out and finding some kind of cover to do so. So it's worth noting that Yusuf is one of the few people in the entire media that have predicted this war accurately. This was at a time when jingoism and patriotism was out of control in the lead up to this war. And of course, we all know in subsequent reporting, a lot of what was reported, particularly in the New York Times, has proven to be basically government propaganda based upon manufactured lies that the administration themselves have put together in order to get into this war that they don't seem to be able to get out of. And obviously, there wasn't a national debate prior to this war, but at least in a small way, we did the right thing on this program. Let me ask you about, we talked once before, a few months ago, Yusuf, about Syria. You used the analogy, Syria is like a low-hanging ripe fruit ready to be plucked. Mm-hmm. Apparently, U.S. Special Forces have been crossing into Syria on raids. They've killed a number of Syrian troops. It's kind of murky in terms of what's going on that border. But how, and of course, you know, the Syrian in charge of Lebanon and who was questioned by the United Nations prosecutor into the death of the Lebanese, former Lebanese leader Hariri, he committed suicide. It's sort of almost like a mafia thing where you either put a bullet in your head or somebody assists you in pulling the trigger. I don't know what version of it you think happened, but
I think he was persuaded.
He was persuaded.
That's they made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
Right. So give me a sense of what the administration's up to in opening a second front in their war on terror, given that their hands are full in Iraq.
The administration, I speak a lot to the military people who are in Doha, Qatar. That's why you probably thought I was in Doha. Yeah. But I've developed quite a few connections with the second command folks who are based in Doha, which is the biggest air base, of course, we have in the Middle East. And as far as 5 months ago, several senior commanders there told me that we were having special operations troops operating right on the border with Syria, that the plan is not so much to invade Syria, but to destabilize Syria. And when I read the report in the New York Times, of course, I was not surprised at all that these special forces are actually physically going into Syria. I believe this is a strategy that has been okayed in the White House as a part of destabilizing Syria. My personal feeling is this current regime in Syria is completely isolated at this point, and the investigation in the murder of al-Hariri was the beginning of the undoing of the whole Ba'athist regime of father and son. It's the last really remnant of this kind of thinking, the use of terror and killing and assassination to dominate the country. The speed with which Syria ran out of Lebanon was absolutely astonishing after 30 years of occupation. So basically, Syria is slowly coming apart, and the administration plan is to help this destabilization in two ways. First, through these special operations, which are putting military pressure. And second, awaiting the investigation, which clearly we know enough now, enough has been leaked from this investigation to suggest that the orders did indeed come from Syria, and probably Ghazi Khankan, who put a gun to his head the other day and killed himself, was one of the principals. Ghazi Khankan ruled Lebanon for 25 years. He could not be disobeyed. He was a godfather. For somebody of such high stature to be persuaded to kill himself or to be killed, actually, we don't really know what happened, if he committed suicide or he was shot, means the beginning of the unraveling of the Syrian mafia that runs both Syria and used to run Lebanon.
And we don't know what's going to replace them, obviously, and And I don't know that the Bush administration does. Let me ask you.
No, they don't.
Let me ask you about this Zahawiri Zarqawi letter. This is a letter purported to be from Zahawiri, the number two in al-Qaeda, the Egyptian intellectual who essentially formed al-Qaeda with bin Laden's money. And he has supposedly written a letter to Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, who has been held responsible for much of the mayhem there. Apparently, there are a number of reports now indicating that this letter could well be a crude forgery along the lines of the Niger forgeries that have become the basis of much of what happened with Wilson and Plame and the special prosecutor, which is another story I want to talk to you about in a second. But what I understand from people who have read the original Arabic version, it's the English version is available.
I wrote it 16 pages. I'm holding it in my hand, actually.
And
I read it in Arabic. It's, let me put it this way, it's too beautiful to be true.
Right.
It's too perfect. It touches on every point that serves, in many ways, the administration purposes. For example, it takes a stab at Al Jazeera, using Al Zawahiri himself, mentioning his close connection to Al Jazeera and the fact that his tapes have been broadcast in Al Jazeera, and asking brother Zarqawi whether he had seen the report in Al Jazeera. That's kind of, somebody like Al Zawahiri would not spend two paragraphs asking a vanity question like that. And then it takes a stab at Pakistan by describing the servile Pakistani regime, which is meant, of course, to arouse the Pakistani authorities to fight al-Qaeda even harder. And then it announces that it's going to take over Egypt and Syria to establish the Syrian caliphate. But it takes the huge stab at the Shiites and by sort of denigrating the most important figure in Shiism, Imam Hussein, and saying, you know, my brother, you realize that Imam Hussein has failed in his project and we don't want to fail. Well, that, you know, will arouse the ire of the Shiites, of course, against the insurgents. So if I were a very, very, very clever, very good Arabist in an intelligence service that belongs to the West that is fighting al-Zawahiri, I would draft such a letter. It serves so many purposes. It hits so many bases. And, of course, why is it being released now? I mean, so how? What about the other communications we intercept? Having said that, Ian, okay. I must add that it is absolutely true that the majority of the Muslim world now is beginning to wonder and beginning to question and becoming rather critical of the methods employed by this maniac, Abu Mus'ab Zarqawi, and of attacking Shiites, of attacking mosques, of attacking civilians, and of killing innocent people. That is a feeling that is spreading. Whether Zawahiri has been used here by any intelligence agency to suggest that there is a split in among the militants themselves is a question, which is the case. But there is certainly a split within the Arab and the Muslim public opinion, with the majority now beginning, a majority of the Muslim and Arabs beginning to say, hey, this is not the way to go in fighting the Americans, whether we like them or we don't like them, and killing innocent people, women and children. These images are being shown on Arab satellites every day and is tearing the hearts of many mothers and fathers. Mm. The letter may be a fake, but in the greater public, there is a split in sentiment.
Yeah, I understand also that the letter, its salutations are not those of these Wahhabi Salafists like Zahawiri and Zarqawi. They're almost the equivalent of Jerry Falwell writing a letter to Pat Robinson, and instead of saying yours in Christ, he'd be saying Hail Mary or something that's completely out of a different faith.
I dwelt on this a bit. I can't make up my mind. I'm not sure can say that. But I'm having read the letter twice. As I said, it's too too good, right. too pretty, too perfect.
Right. Well, that's in the last minute then, Yusuf Ibrahim, since you're a 25-year veteran with the New York Times, I believe you had dinner with a bunch of senior New York Times people. I guess it's Miller time at the New York Times, right?
That's one of the most serious crises the Times has faced. I've had dinner a few days ago with some very senior people who are my friends and colleagues. And I was struck by two things, the degree inside the New York Times, the degree of suspicion and resentment toward Judith Miller, and in fact, outright accusations that she's lying still, and the fact that people are losing a lot of respect for Bill Keller, the executive editor, who has now watched over two significant failures by the New York Times, the whole weapons of mass destruction scandal, which was reported by Judith Miller, that forced the New York Times into public apology, and then now this new thing with Judith, in which if you read it carefully, the paper today is basically disowning Miss Miller completely. It is describing her as an intrepid reporter, a difficult person, somebody whose reports are not reliable. And you can sense the paper has distanced itself from her, but in the process, for Keller to say something like the default position in a case like this is to support your reporter is completely idiotic, since his predecessor, Howell, was fired precisely because he covered up for an incompetent reporter who was lying. So basically, the Times has been in crisis. It's my paper. I love it. It's my alma mater. It kind of hurts you. And I could see the pain the other day in the face of my old colleagues who are all senior guys in the paper right now. This is a great paper, and it has been embarrassed and humiliated first under Howard Raines and now again under Bill Keller. And it's time for Arthur Sulzberger to clean the house. Judith Miller should have been fired after the scandal of the weapon mass destruction, in which her main source was Ahmed Chalabi. And she wrote a bunch of stories. She supported the war, and she wrote a whole bunch of stories. But the worst part about this, the most critical, is that a lot of people inside the New York Times actually believe in these articles today, perhaps suggest that Judith was part of the movement to out the wife of Wilson as a revenge for Wilson really dumping on all her stories about weapon mass destruction. And the stunning thing is that many people inside the Times really believe that.
So she had a dog in this fight, as Bill Clinton would say.
Oh, she was completely humiliated over the crash of her weapon of mass destruction.
Well, Yusuf, I'd love to talk more about this, and we shall stay in touch. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Yusuf Ibrahim, a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. And he is also the managing director of Strategic Investment Group in Dubai, where he does risk analysis on the oil market. And I'm now speaking with Bill Press, who's a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. He's a co-host of MSNBC's Buchanan and Press. He was also co-host of CNN's Crossfire. And he has formerly served as a chairman of the California Democratic Party. And his new book, How the Republicans Stole Christmas, The Republican Party's Declared Monopoly on Religion and What Democrats Can Do to Take It Back. Thank you for your book, Bill, and for joining us. Having captured the flag, the Republicans have now captured the Bible. I mean, it does seem extraordinary, one, that they got away with capturing the flag. I guess you go back to the 50s when that happened. The Bible used to belong to the political left in the days of William Jennings Bryan, who, after all, was the guy that advocated creationism in the Scopes trial, which is being revisited as we speak.
Right.
In those days when he was running against McKinley, the people in the Farm Belt, the red states, as it were all on the left, and the Bible was reposed in the left wing spectrum. So how did it migrate? How did the Prince of Peace, the prophet, the man who didn't carry an AK-47, he didn't celebrate capital punishment, he didn't hang out with rich people on Lear jets, he kissed the lepers and ministered to the poor, how did he get expropriated?
Well, you don't have to go back as far as William Jennings Bryan if you just look at the, you're absolutely right, but look at the civil rights movement, you know, born out of the, basically, black churches, carried banner high by Democratic politicians. It was a religious crusade, really, the civil rights movement, and it was a movement on the left among progressives and liberals and yeah, Southern Democrats, for which they suffered, right? Nixon's Southern strategy. And I think what happened is, or three things as I see it. One is, beginning in 1979, with the creation of the Moral Majority, the religious right moved into the political field. They had been on the sidelines before, but when certain Supreme Court decisions came down, dealing with school prayer, dealing with Bible, reading the Bible in schools, dealing with integration, to be honest, the religious right felt that they had to get involved. They did so. They formed this unholy alliance with the Republican Party. They are supporting Republicans, so the Republicans will support their issues, and Republicans want them, so they'll help elect other Republicans. That's number one. Number two, then, once that alliance was formed, they proceeded to define Christianity so narrowly that I think if Jesus Christ himself came back today, he wouldn't qualify for the club. You know, their brand of Christianity is limited to abortion and gay marriage. I mean, that's all they're talking about. They ignore the social gospel. They ignore the message of Jesus. They ignore the message, as you pointed out, of the gospel, where Jesus certainly didn't identify with the rich or give them tax cuts, right? He kissed the lepers and hung out with the poor and with the prostitutes. But the third thing that happened, which distresses me, is as the Republican religious right moved in and Republicans formed this alliance, the Democrats moved out, so that today you have, for the most part, Democrats like John Kerry, who don't talk about values, don't talk about morality, don't profess their faith. And I think they've left the field to the what I call the American Taliban.
Well, I think even in spite of the fact that Karl Rove said that in 2000, 4 million evangelicals didn't show up to vote Republican, and then
right.
In 2004, I think he got every last one of them.
Well, he did, because again, with this unholy alliance, the religious right figured, well, what can we do to get our base out to vote? They came up with this crazy scheme of, well, we'll put gay marriage, banning gay marriage initiatives on the ballot in 11 states. And, of course, George Bush, who jumps when they say, you know, how high when they say jump, I guess is what I was trying to point out. Bush did them a huge favor by announcing this constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, which he knew was going nowhere. We all knew was going nowhere. It was strictly an electoral ploy using religion as a political tool.
But, Bill Press, tell me which universe this perfect world resides in, where you don't have abortions, there's no teen pregnancy, there's no extramarital sex, there are no gay people. What world are we talking about here?
Well, for some evangelicals, I guess, they're talking perhaps...
And where there's no divorce, by the way, and it's worth noting that the highest divorce rate is in the South, and the lowest is in Massachusetts.
Certainly, we're certainly not talking about the world we live in. You know, for some evangelicals, they believe maybe it's life after death, maybe it's paradise, but I'm not even sure it exists.
You mean sex after death?
But, you know, it is true, and I point out in the book that this idea that the people in red states have moral values and people in the blue states have none, I mean, it's just absurd on the face of it. But when you look at the numbers, the divorce rate is much higher in the red states than it is in the blue states, and the blue states have much higher population, right? Teenage pregnancy is higher in the red states. Alcoholism, just child abuse by members of the family. You run down the list. Desperate Housewives has bigger ratings in Oklahoma City than it does in Los Angeles. I think in the book there's a lot going on under the belt in the Bible Belt.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill Press, who's a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. He was the co-host of MSNBC's Buchanan and Press. He also co-hosted CNN's Crossfire. He was the chairman of the California Democratic Party. And his new book, How the Republicans Stole Christmas, The Republican Party's Declared Monopoly on Religion, and What Democrats Can Do to Take It Back.
Ian, may I jump in just
sure.
a sec? Because the one thing you did mention, which I just want to be sure people understand, I don't deny anything you said. Guilty as charged.
Right.
But I did want to point out, you know, I was raised a Catholic, I went to Catholic. I was an altar boy. I went to Catholic high school. I joined the seminary after high school because I wanted to study for the priesthood. I believe at the time I had what is called a vocation. I spent 10 years in the seminary. I have a degree in theology from the University of Fribourg in Switzerland. So I know these issues, and the reason I wrote the book is because I was outraged to wake up one morning and be told that by Jerry Falwell that as a Christian, I had to vote for George W. Bush. That was my Christian duty. Well, where the hell is that in the New Testament? And then I'm told by a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church, Cardinal Chaput from Denver, that as a Catholic, I could not go to communion because I have voted for John Kerry and committed this grievous sin, you know. And I mean, that to me is just
well. But you know, there's a political genesis to that. Apparently, Cardinal Ratzinger was in touch with Karl Rove, and they worked out that strategy. Ratzinger sent a letter to the U.S. bishops. I've talked to many people whose dear old mothers had voted Democrat all their life, and they told me their sons told me that. They'd heard that their mothers had voted Republican for the first time, and why did you do this? And they said, because our priest told us to.
Well, yes, when Bush visited John Paul II at the Vatican, he asked the Pope to put the word out, or his aides did, whatever, probably Karl Rove and Ratzinger, right? But they made the request right then and there to help us win this election by getting word to your bishops that they got to get involved on the social issues, namely abortion, in the United States in the next election. And either Ratzinger did it without, or Ratzinger did it with John Paul II's approval. But message delivered, and message was sent to the bishops and the priests in the United States, which is exactly what we worried about when John F. Kennedy was running for office.
Right, but it happened to work in a heavily Catholic state, Ohio.
It did indeed.
They peeled off enough votes, even though there was clearly a lot of voter fraud that still hasn't been addressed. Let me ask you, though, Bill. Just you know, obviously, this is a time when. When you know there's an old adage in politics, you stay out of the other out of the other guy's way when he's self-destructing, and clearly the Republicans with Bush at all-time low ratings, with the head of the House under two separate indictments for two different grand juries in Texas, with the head of the Senate under an SEC investigation for dumping shares that were supposed to be in a blind trust. And the president himself, this week, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I had Lawrence O'Donnell on, who broke the story earlier that Karl Rove was named in the Time magazine documents that the special prosecutor finally was handed. Larry got that right, and he said that there'll be two indictments of both Libby and Rove probably next week, plus a third senior figure that he didn't want to name. I suspect it may be Newt Gingrich, but that's just my thought. The long and the short of it is, so this
I
is.
I think that's your wish.
Well, he was involved in the workup not well known, but he was involved in the workup well before Wilson wrote that op-ed piece. He was in their crosshairs, and as our previous guest may have mentioned, that Judy Miller may well have been shopping the information about Valerie to people that subsequently used it. So the long and the short of it is, Bill Press, this is going to be a bad week for the president coming up probably. The two deputies to the two top guys in the country may well be indicted, and certainly as it stands now, the head of the House and head of the Senate are under a substantial cloud. So obviously, this is a time for the Democrats to step up with their own narrative. I hear rumors that there's going to be a Democratic equivalent of the Contract with America. Where do you hear about what Rahm Emanuel's up to?
Well, I hear that, too. Let me back up for just a second. I mean, this may be a bad week for the president, but it's coming on top of a ton of bad weeks, right? I mean, despite the vote for the Constitution, looks like it passed, and frankly, I hope it did, Iraq is still a disaster for the president. It's not going to stop the violence, and that's not getting any better. You know, they dropped the Social Security plan this week, finally admitted that's a dead duck. You know, the response to Katrina, the Harriet Myers flap, and on top of that, you've got this stink of corruption from Capitol Hill to the White House with Tom DeLay and Bill Frist and, you know, Jack Abramoff and David Savavian, who was head of the procurement office in the White House, who's actually arrested, not just indicted, but arrested for his dealings with Abramoff. And now Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. And the name that I hear, Ian, is actually former Press Secretary Ari Fleischer.
Right.
as perhaps the third person to be indicted. But look, Patrick Fitzgerald did not call Roe back for a fourth time because he wanted to hear how the recovery effort for Katrina is going. That's a joke, right? I mean, they had lots of questions for Karl Rove. He's clearly a target, no matter what they say. And I think it's going to come down. I think it's going to be heavy on this White House. Just a quick story, and then I'll get to your point about the Democrats. I was on CNN's Situation Room with Bay Buchanan on Friday, and Wolf Blitzer asked Bay what she thought about all this, and she said, "Well, she felt that the problem was the Democrats were overplaying their hand in this Valerie Plame investigation." And I said, "Wait a minute." What do Democrats have to do with this investigation? Nothing. This is a Republican prosecutor investigating leaks allegedly committed, right, by Republican, top Republican operatives in a Republican White House after a speech given by a Republican president of the United States. So, Democrats are doing the smart thing here, I think, which is sitting on the sideline and watching the Roman Empire crumble. I do hear also, but I think that's not enough. I mean, you know, in politics, for the other side to screw up badly, as this side is a good start, but it's not enough. That means people are looking around for a new direction, which they are. You've seen the polls as well as I. But they also need a reason for moving in another direction. I don't believe Democrats have given them that. You know, Newt Gingrich, you mentioned earlier, his brilliant strategy, it was pure nonsense, this contract with For America or On America, whatever it was. But it was effective. Not one of those proposals, by the way, including term limits. Not one of those proposals has ever seen the light of day. But at least they stood up and said, we stand for something, you give us the control, and here's what we're going to do. I think Democrats have to do that, and they should have done it a month ago, but they have to be out there very, very soon with their agenda, their program.
Well, let me just give you a little bit to chew on, Bill. Here, for example, I mean, it seems that the Republicans, with DeLay and all of his troubles, it indicates a kind of... if you will, putting it generously, a political philosophy that essentially comes down to the fact that the Republicans represent capital. Now, whether the Democrats still represent people, there's some question about that. But there's no question that of the bankruptcy of the Republican project, because if the purpose of government to them is to take public monies and give it to their private the hands of their private friends and cronies.
Absolutely.
And I'll just give you
a good job of it.
Well, this is an example that just absolutely burns me up. You know, there's a lot of unemployed people down in New Orleans, and the city just had to lay off workers. Do you realize that these sole source, no bid contracts that Halliburton are getting, the first thing that Bush did after the Katrina was to suspend the Davis-Bacon Act,
correct.
Which means that federal monies were tied to union labor. Now the Halliburtons are not constrained. They're bringing in busloads of undocumented Mexicans, paying them $5 an hour. In turn, they're charging FEMA, which is you and me, the taxpayers of this country. They're charging them $20 an hour. So they're making 300% profit per head in a town where the local people desperately need work. Now, if that's not an example of diverting public funds into private hands, and, you know, this administration, they profit from their own catastrophes. Iraq is a catastrophe.
Who's
making out? Halliburton and the oil companies, all of their friends. A natural disaster comes along. Who makes out? The same people.
No, so they make money out of people's misery, and they have in Iraq. They're doing so in Louisiana. I saw the other day this whole idea. Davis-Bacon was one. Remember, also the president said the local people were going to make sure they get the contracts, they get the work. They're the ones that need the work. I saw the other day out of 140 contracts that have been let by a Department of Homeland Security in the New Orleans area, two out of 140 have gone to local contractors. All the rest have gone to KBR, you know, Halliburton and the like. No, it's absolutely another case of their giving their buddies the bucks.
Just in closing, then, Bill, if as we have discussed, there is some plan afoot, some kind of manifesto that's being drawn up. Clearly, it's overdue and much anticipated. But the long and the short of it is, it seems to me that what's lost in this debate is that we have strayed so far from politics, so that we have become a nation of passive consumers and not active citizens, that civics are no longer taught. People don't really vote. And when they do vote, they don't tend to vote like the rest of the democracies do, where you put people in power who actually do something for you.
Yeah.
They deliver
yeah.
services. We are so alienated and detached. All we talk about is prayer in school, abortion, flag burning, stuff that has nothing to do with bread and butter issues,
correct.
Which every other democracy votes on. So is there a way that we can somehow re-engage the American people in the very purpose of voting and the very purpose of democracy, which is you pay your taxes and you get your services, instead of what we're doing now is we pay our taxes and that money goes to the friends of Bush and Cheney?
Well, yes, I think it is still possible. I certainly hope so, because I've been involved in this political system, you know, for 30-some years, and I still have faith in the process. I think people are looking for leadership. I think that people will respond to leadership, and that's, again, why I think somebody strong on the Democratic side has to stand up. And, I mean, you and I could maybe disagree, or we could go on all afternoon about what should be in that Democratic manifesto. But, you know, I think it has to be bold and visionary and courageous. I mean, you know, I think they ought to say, look, we're going to end this war in Iraq. We're going to bring the troops home now. You know, we're going to give every school kid in America a laptop computer, or we're going to achieve energy independence. You know, we're going to fix Social Security once and for all. We're going to take away those Bush tax cuts and give them to the middle class. I mean, I think they've got to go forward and stop pussyfooting around. There have been too many Democrats for me in Washington. They voted for the Bush tax cuts. They voted for the Bush Medicare plan. They voted for the Bush judges.
You know,
and the Bush wars, yeah. And we didn't put them there to be Republican light. So, you know, I think Democrats, the American people, are ready for a major change in direction. And Democrats will either provide it, or, you know, we'll get somebody else.
Just a quick last word, Bill. Why should people get your book? Because obviously you've got some ammunition for them in this book.
Well, I would hope people would read it, because I think this whole question about the basic connection, if you will, between faith and politics is one of the most important issues in this country. We've been trying to get it right for 225 years. We don't have it right yet, and this is my attempt to maybe shed some light on that. But also, I think anybody who has any faith at all in any divine being at all does not want to see the Republican Party and the religious right control the market on faith. And so I think we got to fight back, and I think I give some good arguments here on why we need to do so and how we need to do so.
Well, thanks for joining us, Bill Preston.
They stole the flag. Now, they stole religion. I guess what I'm saying, Ian, is it's time for us to steal it back.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us, Bill.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking then with Bill Press, who is formerly a nationally syndicated columnist with MSNBC's Buchanan and Press, then with CNN's Crossfire. He was formerly the chair of the California Democratic Party. It's the author of a new book, How the Republicans Stole Christmas, the Republican Party's Declared Monopoly on Religion and What Democrats Can Do to Take It Back. Peter Irons is joining us now. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, the author of a number of books, including A People's History of the Supreme Court. His new book, War Powers, How the Imperial Presidency Hijacked the Constitution. And Peter, just before we get into talking about war powers, how the imperial presidency hijacked the Constitution, and of course... We know that the last Supreme Court Chief Justice, who was just voted in and is now sitting on the court, presiding over the other associate justices, and he will be there for decades to come, presumably. Justice Roberts was basically, his qualifications more than anything was that he was an advocate, a lawyer for the executive branch. So the second person that Bush chooses, Associate Justice, to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, is another presidential lawyer, in this case, President Bush's own lawyer. So what is going on here in this country? Have everybody, the press and the public, forgotten what the Constitution is about? It's about the separation of powers. The judicial branch is its own branch of government. It shouldn't be an extension of the executive branch. And the process itself of nominating and approving is equally split between the executive, who nominates for the court, and the Senate, who decide whether or not that nominee is suitable. Where did we get this idea that somehow this process is so hallowed that you can't possibly interfere with the president's judgment?
Well, in fact, the Senate, Ian, has in the past turned down nominees on grounds that they were, in fact, too extreme for the Supreme Court, Robert Bork being the most recent example of this. But I think what the nomination of Judge Roberts, who is now the Chief Justice, and Harriet Myers, the President's counsel, reflects is the President's belief that he can push through the Senate his own nominees, people who reflect his own views, and because the Senate is controlled by his party, it looks like he is pretty much getting away with that strategy.
Yeah, but what? How does that explain the senators themselves? Don't they have any institutional pride in their independence as the legislative body, that they are there to advise and exhibit oversight? How come they've become a rubber stamp for the executive branch?
Well, I think one reason, Ian, is that many of the senators, considering that half of the Democrats voted for Judge Roberts when he was confirmed very recently, are willing to basically abdicate their oversight responsibility and to accept virtually anybody the president puts up who is at least arguably competent. Now, there's no question that Judge Roberts was competent. I mean, he had a very outstanding record, not only in law school as managing editor of the Harvard Law Review, but in private practice and working in the Justice Department and later as a Court of Appeals judge. There's a much greater question that Harriet Myers has the competence to serve on the Supreme Court, at least considering the range of candidates the president might have chosen from.
Yeah, well, even conservatives, mostly conservatives are dumping on it. The New York Times columnist David Brooks had a piece the other day where he went through when she was the head of the Texas Bar, apparently their newsletter, there'd be a message from the president, a weekly column or a monthly column, I guess. And it was kind of the wit and wisdom of Harriet Myers, and it was pretty appalling. I mean, it was just kind of pathetic corporate doublespeak, just absolute drivel. So it'll be interesting to see when this woman has to appear before the cameras and the public, whether there's something there or whether she's an empty suit, or is that the right, I guess, for a woman? I don't know if it's an empty suit, but anyway.
Well, it's interesting because David Brooks is obviously the most conservative columnist in the New York Times, and other conservatives have raised similar questions about Harriet Myers. First of all, her only legal experience has been as a corporate lawyer in a big firm in Texas and working directly for President Bush. She has no record at all of having either written about or ruled on, since she's never been a judge, issues of constitutional law that would come up before the Supreme Court. Mm. And so, in effect, she's a blank slate.
Well, apparently she hasn't even had a conversation in all the years that they've been together about the great issues of the day, like abortion.
Well,
if you can believe that, I've got a bridge for sale.
That's what she claims, and I find that, as you do, hard to believe. But I think also that the main reason that conservatives are raising questions about Harriet Myers is that many of them fear that she might, in fact, become another David Souter or Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. Just as people feared that Roberts might become that.
Mm.
So I think what's going on, and the Democrats, of course, are standing on the sidelines, in effect, licking their lips, waiting for these confirmation hearings, is that they're willing to let the Republicans fight this out among themselves. And by the time the confirmation hearings begin, Harriet Myers might not be a really credible candidate.
We're just touching on a subject from Peter's previous book, A People's History of the Supreme Court. Obviously, there's some interest now in the new nominee who was chosen by the president, who says he knows her heart, knows who she is, and is an odd a constellation of political pressure building against her with Democrats, senators on the left and Republican senators on the right forming a de facto coalition to torpedo her nomination. Who might well replace her if indeed she goes down, either if she withdraws under pressure or is found wanting in her performance before the Senate Judiciary Committee? We'll know soon enough. But the White House itself is in a lot of trouble, clearly, with the head of the House, Tom DeLay, under two separate indictments in Texas, and the head of the Senate, Bill Frist, being investigated by the Securities Exchange Commission, and the possibility next week that the second most powerful men in the country, the chief of staff to the vice president, Scooter Libby, and the assistant chief of staff, and essentially joined at the hip with George Bush, Karl Rove, will likely be indicted by the special prosecutor, along with a third senior official who is yet to be identified. Just to give you an idea of where we stand in terms of an imperial presidency, just a few weeks ago, Peter Irons, President Bush signed into law a new agency called the National Security Service. This is an agency that Bush controls directly. It's America's first secret police. Arguably, it's Bush's own Gestapo. The Fourth Circuit Court recently declared that U.S. gave the president the right to declare U.S. citizens as enemy combatants. And in a bill that was just voted in, there was a 90-9 Senate vote urged by John McCain to ban torture. The president even threatened to veto this $445 billion defense bill because of he felt his hands were being tied over torture. So there goes what's left of the Eighth Amendment. Then you've got Patriot Act II, which allows administrative subpoenas. So that shreds what's left of the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, the Senate Select Intelligence Committee recently voted to allow the Pentagon to spy on U.S. citizens, thus breaking that wall between police and surveillance, crime and political surveillance. That's a catalog of where we've just gone recently. So if these two Roberts is in, and if the next one gets in, that's two Supreme Court justices with a clear and obvious bias towards executive authority. Who's going to challenge this president?
Well, that's a good question, Ian. In my view, the only real challenge can come from Congress and the American people. You know, Congress in the past, ever since Harry Truman sent troops into Korea in 1950, has virtually abdicated its constitutional role over war powers. And presidents since then, both Democrats and Republicans, in fact, have gone along with that. So what we wind up with is, as I say, an imperial presidency that really has no effective check. And, of course, as you pointed out in your catalog of horrors in these bills coming through Congress, that is not only dangerous, but it's also reminiscent of the kind of powers that the Gestapo in Germany and the NKVD in Soviet Russia exercised over the people in those countries. I'm not suggesting that we're close to those parallels, but I am suggesting, and I think you probably agree, that we're getting perilously close to a situation in which the American people really have no recourse. Congress is not going to help them. The courts are not going to help them. And so we just have to wait until the American public decides they've had enough.
Obviously, we have one of the most imperial presidents we've ever had, I think, in terms of his own. He never explains what he's doing and what he thinks. He just keeps saying, trust me. He has gotten this country into a war that it clearly doesn't know how to get out of, and they've never been able to explain what they went in there for in the first place. It was an unnecessary war, an optional war, a war of this president's own making. Originally, back in May of 2003, after their lightning victory in Operation Iraqi Freedom, previously known as Operation Iraqi Liberation, until somebody pointed out that acronym spelled oil. He, on the May the 1st, on the aircraft carrier, just off your hometown there in San Diego, he declared mission accomplished. Only a week ago, on television, he said that we can't afford to lose this war that apparently we already won. So this president, it is amazing that he could still be there, to be such a serial incompetent, to have so little regard for the American people, to have conducted his administration in such utter secrecy. But, you know, as much as we can whine and complain, Peter Ines, the truth of the matter is that Bush and Cheney and their friends are all getting incredibly rich out of his disasters. The oil companies are having record profits, and Halliburton is not only cleaning up in Iraq, but they're also cleaning up down in New Orleans. So maybe we're the stupid ones here.
Well, you know, one thing I just thought of, Ian, is that this is a good argument, everything you've just said, for the parliamentary system of government, in which a prime minister or a president who totally destroys the support of the public and loses that support can be voted out of office before their term would normally expire. Now, I don't think our Congress has the kind of resolve that would be necessary to vote President Bush out of office and replace him with, or hold new elections for a new government. But it does point out that presidents become seduced by the power of their office. It really doesn't matter who the president is. Now, I think President Bush has this notion based sort of on his evangelical beliefs that we are destined by divine providence to rule the world. But at the same time, as you point out, there are profits to be made in conducting these kinds of wars and extending the American empire around the world. And, you know, I think that if you put those two factors together, this sort of basic religious belief that God has made us the number one country in the world, and that we can reap the profits of that dominance, you know, you come to a point in history where an empire shows signs of that it might collapse. And I think that the debacle in Iraq might be a sign of that. I'm working on a chapter right now that tries to explain why these very vague commands in the Ten Commandments have been translated into a code of behavior that fits into the whole program of the religious right. I mean, they are very hostile to anybody, and that includes most of us, who differ from their views, and they are determined to impose this through law. And I think that, you know, the thing that links the imperial presidency and this domestic political movement is that they are willing to turn over to those in authority the decisions, you know, basically to ignore the command of the Constitution that everyone shall have due process of law and equal protection of law, and that minorities shall be protected. I mean, this is really a push to establish a majority government that has no regard for minorities at all.
and essentially a Sharia, a state religion, with the American Taliban running our lives. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Peter Irons, and for your book, War Powers, How the Imperial Presidency Hijacked the Constitution.
It's been my pleasure, Ian.
Thanks a lot. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wynn and Carol Coots, the assistant producer. This program and all previous programs are available at ianmasters.org, where there's also podcasting.